These squeaky swings are a popular place to play during recess at Callaway County, Kentucky's East Elementary School. Eight or so elementary-age kids are pumping their legs to swing as high as they possibly can. Occasionally, one jumps out, and some others are dangling side to side. More than 70% of the children at East qualify for free and reduced lunch, which is a strong indicator of living in poverty. Callaway County, like the rest of our region, has a poverty rate of a little more than 18%. In a new report from the Brookings Institution, on average, children born into poverty have about a 40% chance of staying in poverty. Those numbers vary widely, though, based on race, family, and educational attainment. So despite how hard these kids pump their legs to swing as high in the air as they can, it will take much more effort to get out of poverty. Coming up on Living on the Line, we'll meet three people who, as children, were like many of the kids at East, and they are all on a swing of their own, descending into poverty, dangling in the middle, and pumping their legs to get out. These stories are here to put a face and context to the cycle of poverty. Thirty-nine-year-old Joseph Lee Taylor of Paducah was happy and gainfully employed after battling his way out. He's optimistic and driven, but he's just now finding himself in a financial situation that could prove to be perilous. Whitney Jones brings us his story on the trigger that put his hard-earned stability in jeopardy.
Joseph's day starts early. He hops out of his bed in Paducah, usually around 6:30. He's twice divorced and has no kids to prepare for school. So once he's ready, he gets right to his books.
I am currently a student with West Kentucky Tech. I am getting my associate's degree, and I am less than one semester away from that, and then I will be attending Murray State and getting my bachelor's degree. I am currently unemployed, but I do student work program for the college to help pay for tuition. If it's a school day, I get up, I study. I usually spend the first couple of hours studying. My first class will probably kick in about 9. I go from
Joseph
class from
is working toward a goal, and a pretty typical one at that. The classic American dream, a middle class life. He's had a taste of that life, but before we get to that, let's start at the beginning. Joseph's first job, which he got during his days at Paducah Tillman High School.
I started working at a local company here making $3.25 an hour. That was about the minimum wage back then. And so bringing home $200 to $300, you had to make do. I came up from a very poor family. My dad was a truck driver. My mother at the time was a secretary. She got injured and was put on disability. So not only was when my dad was on the road, I was taking care of my younger sister and helping my mom at the time, who was in a wheelchair. And then I'm managing two jobs and I'm trying to go to college.
Joseph admits he failed some classes then. He was juggling multiple jobs and taking care of his family.
It's very difficult for someone, say, in that situation to go, how am I going to get out of this? I do not see a way out to better myself and yet bring everybody else with me without abandoning them. I was having difficulties at work because my first job was wanting me to move in a career path in the company that I wasn't comfortable with. And so I was getting forced in that direction because I was coming up on 21 and getting CDLs and joining, being on the road as well, doing truck driving. And that would have took me away from my family without a change in pay. And so I decided that, started looking at my options, and then I saw this great ad.
It doesn't matter whether you're a man or a woman, only that you're good.
Slowly.
Roger.
Overlanding threshold.
Be all that you can be.
Thanks for your help.
Roger.
You can do it in the Army.
We'll pay for college and excitement and adventure. And, you know, this is before 9-11. I mean, so I was like, sure, what's the odds of us going to war and everything? And I can get my degree, I can help, I'll be still making money, and everything will be great. Well, I made that decision, and then I told my family, and my mom's side of the family is very military. They were happy for me. My mom was not. She did not like me going into the service. My dad was like, hey, great, you're becoming a man, hurrah. But he didn't like the fact that when he found out that I was gonna be stationed who knows where, he wasn't so happy about that, because it wasn't just, where are you gonna be at? I don't know. Well, I'm gonna be in Fort McClellan at first. Oh, that's great. Well, I came home for 6 days. Oh, by the way, now I'm going to South Korea. I'm not too happy about that, because then they had to go. Now we have to take care of our own problems. And so part of me feels like I abandoned them.
Joseph's situation might lead you to believe that the armed forces are made up of more people from a poverty-stricken background than those in middle or upper-class families. That's understandable. Enlisting makes all these promises, a job, an education, a way out. But that assumption simply isn't the case. Two studies, one from the right-leaning Heritage Foundation and the other from the nonpartisan National Priorities Project, found people who come from low-income families, let's say less than $35,000 a year, are actually underrepresented in the military. The group with the highest rate of enlisting is the middle class. Now, let's get back to Joseph's story. He served for 5 years as an officer, monitoring checkpoints and occasionally scouting areas. He wasn't able to take classes while in the military. He didn't have time. But Joseph did serve all over the globe.
Germany, Kosovo, Africa. In my 6 years of being in the military, I was maybe stateside or home for maybe 2 years, maybe two and a half. So I was gone almost half the time.
But serving in the Army didn't fully prepare him for some aspects of civilian life.
Everything was paid for, except for car, insurance, groceries. But the basic stuff was taken care of. So it was a huge change to come out and say, oh, well, now I got to deal with rent costing this much. Oh, here's all my utilities, my insurance. And they try to give you some package compensation formula that with all your benefits in the military at your rank, this is how much in the real world you need to kind of make. Well, it wasn't that helpful. And then when I said to get out and I was like, hey, now I can go to school. I can't really do that because I got to find a full-time job that will take care of my expenses.
While veterans like Joseph have some obstacles to overcome after serving, their poverty level is actually lower than the civilian populations. The U.S. Census Bureau used information from 2008 to 2012 to find an estimate of veterans in poverty. Their findings, 8% of veterans have lived under the poverty line in the past year. For civilians, it's almost double that, at 14%. Now, fortunately for Joseph, he didn't go too long until he got a more than minimum wage job, which lessened his financial worries.
Once I got out, less than 3 months later, I applied for a job to work out at USEC, the gas diffusion plant. The base rate of pay out there was between $50,000 and $60,000.
This is the beginning of a new chapter, where Joseph's American dream starts to come true. Joseph bought a starter home in Paducah, not far from his job. He was comfortable as a federal peace officer at USEC. He even thought he'd retire from the gaseous diffusion plant. But fast forward about a decade.
Tsunami hit. They don't need nuclear energy anymore for Japan. That was our biggest customer at USEC, and now USEC is now closing. I started seeing these signs. I'm like, I got to get my life in order because I don't know how long this job's going to be here.
The first layoffs in August 2013 didn't affect his department, but when more rounds came in early 2014, it was his time to go.
I started researching everything that I knew back in June last year. And it took me 8 months to go, okay, I need to do this first. I need to do this, 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 and made a list. And I hate to say, when you started on one of those tasks, it broke down into four other things. And then you had to go, okay, how can I prioritize this to make sure I'm getting everything done? So I started school before I was even laid off. I was working over 40 hours and had 12 hours worth of college. I was dying. Come the weekend, I didn't go out. I sat at home and I did my schoolwork. But that's what had to be done in order to, I made L.A.'s, barely, but I made A's, and I'm on the dean's list now.
After After weighing his options, Joseph decided to take a practical route in his next career. He's now taking business classes and hopes to become an accountant.
And everybody pays taxes.
Although that wasn't his first choice.
I was a criminal justice major, and now I'm doing business and accounting because I'm not a spring chicken, can't chase 17-year-old punks anymore.
Drive up to Joseph's home, and you probably wouldn't think he's on the edge of poverty. It's a nice starter home, 3 bedrooms, a back porch for grilling on a summer night. A blue Mustang is parked in the garage, with a Kawasaki motorcycle sitting out front. He also has a Harley-Davidson motorcycle out back. His everyday vehicle is a green pickup truck. To some, that might seem gratuitous for a man living off unemployment. Yes, Joseph rides the motorcycles to wind down, decompress, but he also sees his vehicles as investments that will save him down the line.
When I got the motorcycle, I bought it to resell. The person who I bought the Harley from basically literally gave it away to me. And my best friend, he's like, I don't want to give it to somebody else. He's like, whatever I owe on it, that's what you have to pay. And if you looked at it, you're like, oh, that's $7,000-$8,000 bike. I probably didn't pay more than $2,000. And I plan on reselling it. My other motorcycle, I'm going to sell, and my Mustang before my college is done. I see those 3 things gone.
Joseph's school is mostly paid for through his GI Bill, but his unemployment will run out soon, and he still has to make a mortgage payment.
I've already figured I'm going to go 6 months without any pay unless I go do another part-time job, or which is the only way I see going to full-time at Murray and still stay focused. And so I try to pinch all the pennies that I can. That way my funds will last. I've already made sure my car was paid off. That way I don't have a car payment. I know that would sink me in a heartbeat. I don't plan on trading in, getting a new vehicle anytime soon because I can't afford it. And I have to be realistic about that.
Where does all this determination come from? Like many people, it goes back to lessons Joseph learned as a child.
I like to thank my grandfather who passed away in 91. When I was growing up, it didn't matter what I had to do, but he would make me do work around his house, and he would reward me for doing that work, or I would do the work and not get rewarded if I complained. So he helped kind of slowly instill that work ethic there. When I joined the military, they kind of reinforced that.
That determination and hard work is what has brought Joseph where he is now, going to school, working a job where he's the low man on the totem pole. He's had to make many sacrifices, not just with his pride or his possessions. Joseph admits his social life is a little lacking.
A lot of people you start talking to go, so what are you doing? I'm studying, I'm tutoring, and you know, well, what fun is that? It's not fun. This is my new job in order to get to where I want to be. My truly good friends understand that and support me in that. The people that I'm acquaintances with will try to dissuade me, hey, take a break, let's go out and party, let's blow off some steam, but that's what gets you the B or the C or your D if you do that too much.
So Joseph plugs away at his schoolwork. He knows he's on the edge. One direction is out of poverty, the other is in. He sees people, some of them old coworkers from USEC, struggling, but yet also putting off tasks like registering for school that could put them back on track. His family is another example, too, of what can happen.
They're still struggling themselves. After all these years, I don't see them have moved up any at all. So they're still at that same level, and I feel like I've passed that level, but at the same time, I'm struggling to hold on to what I have now so I don't fall back down even further, because that makes it even harder to get back up.
Joseph says he knows the job market is tough right now in the region. He remains hopeful that once he's done with school, he'll be able to find a place to work using his new skills. He wants to keep moving forward. But Joseph says no matter his situation, he refuses to be poor again.
Poor is a state of mind. Being broke is just financially, you just don't have no money. I've seen that I've had to overcome a lot of obstacles in my life. Being as a child, when I was growing up through elementary and middle school, dyslexic. So I had a handicap. Well, I learned to overcome that. I'm left-handed. In the military, that's a huge, everybody, you do everything right-handed. So I've learned to overcome those things. And so mentally, I know I'll never be poor again. And therefore, no matter how bad it gets,
I know I can go out and do something to make it better.
And true to the planning that's gotten Joseph where he is, he's going to continue overcoming obstacles. That means conserving funds when he has regular income once again.
After I receive my degree and hopefully get my dream job, which everyone hopes they get, I would like to take the time to set up maybe the first 6 months to keep with that pace that I am at now, and then have things set up where I can have that safety net. Because that's one of the things I think everybody needs. But when you're at a level that you can't afford to get the safety net going, you feel like you're right on the edge of that bottomless pit. Where if you spend, you know, you get that great job, don't go out and raise your cost of living up right off the bat. Live on what you are living now and build that safety net. Because once you fall and you land on that net, it's great. But if you fall off the cliff, I can't get back up to the top. And that's a scary, scary thought. And desperation comes from that.
So Joseph continues keeping his head in his books, taking classes during summers, fitting in everything he can. All because that feeling, desperation, that comes from not having enough to survive is something he never wants to experience again.
That was Whitney Jones reporting. Joseph has one semester left at WKCTC before he can begin work at Murray State. During that time, his unemployment benefits and GI Bill benefits will end. According to the Brookings Institute and data from the National Bureau of Labor Statistics, Joseph's degree attainment dropped his chances of getting stuck in poverty to just 16%. You can see a video of Joseph's story and more at WKMS.org. Coming up, hear the story of Angie Smith, who, despite her sunny disposition, hasn't been able to shake her life in poverty. This is Living on the Line, a WKMS News documentary. Welcome back to Living on the Line. I'm Chad Lampe. We're telling stories of people in our region who are at various stages of poverty. We just heard the story of Joseph Lee Taylor of Paducah, who, after being laid off from the Paducah Gaseous Diffusion Plant, is facing the end of unemployment benefits and his GI Bill, and he's determined to get a college degree. Now our swing through the cycle of poverty has us in the middle, this time with a single mom of two who's been diligent about her work, but just can't seem to get out and make enough money. Angie Smith is in the middle of everything, both literally and figuratively. She's a single mom in the middle of raising two kids,
Jolie and Tyler.
She's in the middle of updating and moving into a home built by her late grandfather.
He did all this. I mean, every inch of this he did.
She's in the middle of her life at 42 years old, mostly marked by low-income jobs starting at the age of 18.
There's the dog grooming. I don't know if waiting tables is something. I have house sat and pet sat, so I'm already blank. What was it? The nails. Actually painted a little bit. Would writing go in that? I have farmed and I've cleaned houses.
But that wasn't her plan.
I wanted to work for Greenpeace. I wanted to be on that ship and I wanted to help whales and whatever, anything environmental. Still do.
So what set her on this path of persistent low wages? A number of things. She's an introvert. She switched schools quite a bit growing up. She was insecure about her looks. But this sticks out to her.
Well, I've blogged this before. I was told to quit high school by the principal because I was told that I had never done anything and I would never be anything. And I quit my senior year. He turned out to be a real ass. He had done it to other kids. You know, my freshman year, my dad died. My senior year, I'm told to just quit, give up, and that sent me on a track of probably a couple of years of just rebellious whatever. Not mean. I never got in trouble for anything. I never really did anything to get in trouble, but just kind of to the world, you know, F you.
Then she met a boy, fell in love, got her GED, and started down the path of those various jobs. She planned for her son at the age of 24, then started a nursing school program in Paducah, but along came her second child, and she hasn't been back to school since. So let's take a peek into the life of someone in our region who, like many others, try but can't seem to break through a low-wage lifestyle. And despite her challenges, though, it's important for us to know this about Angie first and foremost.
I don't want much. I've lost people that I love, and so I have people that I love, and they make me happy to have them. That's huge. Family, friends. And then I don't like to shop. I don't like to get my nails done. I may get my hair cut and maybe some highlights maybe twice a year. So I'm not a shopper. I would rather be hiking or gardening. I'm outdoors, free stuff. So I have a happy medium with that. I read a lot also. And so there's a peace about that. You know, there's like, it's a calming, it's a getaway. And plus I'm just that way. I don't know, I was just born that way. I'm just a happy person.
The sunny disposition is admirable, but financially, Angie is hanging on by a thread. Her primary source of income comes from cleaning houses, and her clients have dropped off.
So what would you say your average take-home would be on an average week?
Right now, I can't even. Right now, I have barely. Right now, I make enough to make this payment on this house. The car insurance, which also covers my son, who is a boy, who is 18, which that just drives it way up. That doesn't count who needs a haircut, you need some school supplies, do you need a shirt for school, or it's not counting the gas money for the truck. It's not counting anything right now. What I make is absolutely just paying the bills.
Do you ever talk money with your son?
I do, just enough that, you know, there's really never any money to talk about. There's never any money to save. There's never an emergency stash of cash for whatever could happen. He has seen me, you know, with the truck. And he says, well, if it breaks, we'll just fix it. And I said, there is no fixing this. I cannot have something break down. That's it. I mean, it's just done. Because there are no funds for whatever mishaps.
Angie's professions have been highly dependent on the local economy. Simply put, if people are struggling financially, some of the first expenses they cut are the so-called luxury items like dog grooming, manicures, and house cleaning. Those unstable jobs have prompted Angie to weave in and out of social and financial support networks for 18 years.
A lot of people don't even know that I receive any kind of help, but they are so aggressively angry about it.
Do you receive help?
I do.
So what type of support are you able to get from the government?
We receive food stamps, which then also turns into lunch assistance at the school, and the medical card. When I did walk away from food stamps, I thought I could make it. I thought I can buy these groceries and I can pay these bills. I'm making good, I can do this, and I'm gonna get off of that. Well, then you lose a job or something. Am I going to buy milk for their breakfast in the morning? Or am I going to, and this is what you do, you think, am I gonna buy milk literally down to a couple of dollars? Or am I gonna write this check for a couple dollars short for the water bill, knowing it's going to bounce if I can't get that money back in there before, and you start juggling?
Should people feel embarrassed by receiving support from the government?
I don't think they should, but I kind of don't ask for help from anybody in general. It's hard to say I need anything, because it's the American way, I guess. So you're born and bred American and you work for it and anything's possible. And therefore now, no, it's not. Some people probably are embarrassed about it. I don't now because I'm older, but I would maybe hope I didn't see anybody I knew when I went in. I'm going to be associated with being a certain way.
What would you tell a critic if they think that you're being a mooch?
That you don't need
yeah,
it.
Yeah, or you're not trying hard enough.
I don't know what to say to those people because I don't think there's anything you can say. I don't think they're gonna hear it. I don't think they are in reality. I think that they go do what they want, when they want. They don't watch the numbers on the gas, you know, and make sure they don't go over $10. Because that's all they've got to put in it, they don't have to worry about anything. And so they're not in the reality that other people are in. There's no way they could be, you know? But then why is it so easy to judge somebody and to be so angry about it? Because they think that all their tax money, all their extra money is going to that waste for needing help.
One variable that leads to a low-wage lifestyle is coming from a low-wage home. Angie knows this, and she's had tough conversations with her children. According to data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics and the Brookings Institution, as a divorced mother of two, Angie's children have a 32% chance of never leaving a life in poverty. She's talked to them about walking a line of happiness and relative success.
It's no fun going and waiting in line. You do not want to do that. You want a job that is going to let you go on vacations, let you buy your food if you need this or that. You want to be able to have that money for that. You want to be able to save some money. You don't want to be worrying about if that electric truck is pulling up to turn your power off, which is what I've had happen. I don't want to make it all about money, but I think if you can go to bed at the end of the day and know that you've done what you can to make yourself or someone else happy without having hurt anyone or anything, I think that's success. I think it's just that simple.
If you could give any advice to your son at 18 years old, what would you tell him?
I have told him to really try to find something that he really enjoys doing. And it would be excellent, really excellent, to make some money doing it and to be your own boss doing it. But just to love what you do, you know, how can you go wrong with that?
I think it's fair to say that you can't go wrong if you do it the right way, but if you do it the wrong way, there are lots of ways you can go wrong.
Well, yes, but he's probably a lot like me, and so I think that he wants to be outside. His friend is going to be a dental. He's going to do some dental stuff, and he wants to definitely move whenever he's going to go to college somewhere else and do this. And his friend is kind of genius, and so Tyler and his friend, they go on different ends of the spectrum as far as the scoring or any of that. Which I've also told him and my daughter, those scores don't mean anything. It's compared, you know, they're not defining who you are. It's a number. You're great. But I did tell the friend, please have Tyler a job ready when you get to, when you have your own thing going on, hook my kid up. Because Tyler, he really doesn't know exactly what he wants to do right now.
But Angie does, and as with much of her life, she is optimistic.
Do you foresee a time in your life where you won't have to worry about money?
I do. I had three or four things that I had written down a year or so ago. It was definitely in 2013. So it was for 2014 I was going to get this house, not even knowing if it was going to be possible. But that was what I wanted. To be published, it happened. There were a couple more things. They happened. And to be financially secure, and I'm banking on it. I mean, I may be just the, you know, this hopeless kind of whatever, but I'm going to do what it takes.
Angie believes that part of her path to financial stability includes her blog, Smith Shack 71. It's a collection of her musings and photos. She's been paid to write one article, and she's hoping that snowballs into a regular paid job. But she's aware it's idealistic. In the meantime, Angie continues to scrape by and work on her two-bedroom country home for her family of three.
So that is a daybed in the living room. This is my bedroom. But you know, for now, I am so happy to be here that I've said, I don't care if I'm sleeping in a hammock in the woods. I don't care. Who needs a bedroom?
But there's one thing she continues to need, and that's hope, as bills on a home improvement credit card mount and her mortgage begins in October. You can see a video of Angie's story and more at WKMS.org. According to an Urban Institute report, roughly 50% of those who become poor get out of poverty a year later, and the vast majority experience poverty spells of less than 4 years. But despite some of the best intentions and effort, the longer a person has been poor, the less likely he or she is to escape poverty. Next, after a childhood of abuse, poverty, and a car wreck that forced her to grow up overnight, we hear Kara Gaskamp's upswing out of poverty. Welcome back to Living on the Line. I'm Chad Lampe. We've just heard from 42-year-old Angie Smith, a divorced mom of two. She's been stuck in a life of low wages for much of her life. If you remember, she started nursing school before having her second child, but never finished. Our next story is almost like a flashback. Now we meet a 32-year-old divorced mother of two in nursing school who's on the upswing out of poverty. Allison Crawford has her story.
Kara Gaskamp sits comfortably on the couch in her simple and neat two-bedroom apartment as she explains her entrance into poverty. Her mother had remarried when she was seven, and the family was well off. Her mom kept a six-figure income running a private prison and working part-time as a counselor. But her stepfather was abusive. Kara was 10 when her mother drove her and her two siblings from Louisville to Paducah in the middle of the night.
We basically had the clothes on our back and we each grabbed a toy. We drove back to Paducah and my mom's family met us and we stayed with them for a while. She did get a job down here, but the job market is not anything like Louisville, so her income dropped significantly. But we were a lot happier, a lot happier.
Now 32, she glances behind us where her two children are perched on kitchen stools, listening to her story attentively. Kara's little family may not have much, but their happiness is independent of wealth. At the ages of 7 and 12, Josie and Caden speak with a wisdom many of us struggle to grasp in our later years.
How much money you have doesn't really mean that you're rich. You're rich by how you live in your family, and it doesn't necessarily mean you'll be happier. It just means you'll get to get more stuff, not necessarily more happiness.
I love my mom. My mom takes care of me. I'll be a gentleman. I take care of her.
For Kara, happiness has never been dependent on income. But she tells us that after leaving her stepfather, her family crashed further into poverty when her mom got hurt.
She ended up getting injured on the job in a car wreck. She was a home health worker, and a man ran a stoplight and T-boned her. So she was very lucky to even survive that, and it took a long time to get the workman's comp to kick in, and so that's when I started working and helping pay bills, and I was about 14 when I started that.
How much would you say you contributed to your family's income when you were helping your mom?
Oh my goodness. Well, from 14 to 18, I worked 40 hours a week, minimum wage starting out, until she was able to start drawing disability. I mean, it was probably like 80%. My grandparents helped as much as they could. My aunt and uncle helped. We got food stamps and medical cards. But yeah, I mean, it was a significant chunk.
And that was the beginning of the delicate balance Kara maintains between falling off the fiscal cliff and just struggling to stay on it. She had enrolled in homeschool at 13, which helped her manage school and work when she became the breadwinner for her family.
I wasn't into sports. I wasn't into the cheerleading or anything like that. I was shy. I liked to read. I liked to be to myself. And I was thrilled to death with the homeschool arrangement.
I just pretended like I wasn't shy and just talked to everybody and did my job. And I've worked ever since then. I loved it. As far as school goes, we worked year-round. I did schoolwork at home either before or after my shift, and we worked on weekends. We worked through holidays. I did schoolwork through summer. I ended up graduating in 98 when I was 16.
It was not a typical teenage experience. It was stressful and hard, but Kara feels like she was better prepared for adulthood than any of her other peers.
Honestly, I think I have more of an advantage than a lot of kids that grew up with money. A lot of people have trouble surviving on their own, and they don't, you know, or if circumstances change like mine did and something happens and they've lost that support and that income from their parents, I was used to it. So it's, you know, I can be happier in my circumstances than some people who might not be used to that and be thrust into it and be miserable because they don't know how to deal.
Kara continued to work after earning her diploma. When she was 18, her mom's workers' compensation and disability payments started coming in, making her comfortable enough to feel like she could move out and apply for a job at Western Baptist, where her aunt worked.
I felt guilty because my brother and sister, neither one of them had ever really worked much, so I was worried about what they were going to do, but at the same time, I kind of had the feeling that if I didn't just do it, that I never would.
I'd had enough of fast food by then, so I was ready for it. I loved it. Oh, I loved it. I did registration, and I worked in the ER. I worked there until mid-pregnancy with my daughter.
Kara met the father of her daughter, Josie, when she was 19. They had been dating 6 months when she got pregnant. He proposed, but Kara was not interested in marriage. He went with her to some of her doctor's appointments, but then he got cold feet.
He called me at work one night and said that he'd been thinking about it, and he decided that I was going to have an abortion. So I actually think I did laugh at him when he told me that, and I tried to explain and reason with him that he has no role in that decision, that I personally couldn't live with doing that, and if he ever decided to grow up, he could get a hold of me, and I haven't talked to him since.
And does he pay any child support or anything?
No, I haven't requested that. I feel like he lost all rights that night. I don't want anything from him. I got the best part.
Kara had to quit working halfway through her pregnancy in 2001.
That's when I started drawing government assistance for the first time. It was a blow to the pride. I didn't like it. I cried. My mom had to drag me. She's like, you know, if it was just you, I wouldn't worry about you too much, but you're pregnant, you have a baby to take care of, you have to go to the doctor, you have to go.
Her daughter was born with a cantaloupe-sized tumor on her spine. Doctors questioned whether she would survive the first few hours, the next few days, and if she did, whether she would be able to walk or speak.
I had a nurse on her knees on my stomach trying to push her out for me. And the doctor finally felt that, she said, oh my God, there's an abnormality. It was very scary because, you know, they're yelling at me to push and I'm crying and saying I am. And, you know, everybody's panicking because they don't know what's going on. But they rushed me to C-section and they said that they waited till I was out. But I remember vividly them starting to push her back in while I was still awake before the anesthesia took hold. I remember. You don't forget something like that. And then when I was still waking up from the anesthesia, they told me that they were flying her out. So my mom, I had picked out three names that I was down to three names. I wasn't sure what I wanted to name her. And my mom didn't want her to just be baby girl. So she picked one of the names and it was Jocelyn. So she could have a name in case something did happen. She didn't want her to die and not have a name.
But Josie hung on and today is strong and healthy. Kara was not able to work for the first year of her daughter's life, as she was taking Josie back and forth between Paducah and Louisville to Cosair's Children's Hospital. Her appointments were weekly at first, eventually leveling off to twice a year by the time she turned two. Kara had to rely on government assistance and help from family and friends to make it through the first few years. She signed up for Kentucky Transitional Assistance Program, or KTAP, which provides financial and medical assistance to needy, dependent children and their families for up to 5 years. Kara's church helped by pulling money to help pay for the frequent trips to Louisville. She also took advantage of programs that help pay for utilities.
I had to access a lot of help at that time, and I didn't think twice about it because I had to. So it was hard. It was very hard financially back then.
Though Kara struggled with the birth of her first child, the story of her son, Caden, had a more hopeful beginning. Rolling her eyes, she tells me about how she fell in love with Caden's father. But when he stopped working by choice and spent Kara's hard-earned income on Dr. Pepper and cigarettes, she kicked him out.
He wasn't helping out in the household. He slept all day, played video games all night. Josie, can you take Caden outside for a minute?
Yeah, come here, honey. Let's go to the playground.
Okay. I don't like talking bad about his dad in front of him. I've really tried not to do that.
Kara borrowed $300 from a friend to buy a bus ticket and sent her husband back to his mom in Texas.
That wasn't the example that I wanted my son to have as far as what a man's supposed to be. And I still feel guilty that he doesn't see his dad now, and that's the result of the decision I made. But at the same time, I know it's for the best.
What did you want to be when you were growing up? What did you imagine yourself doing?
From the time I was little bitty, I always said I wanted to be a doctor. I love my kids, but I never imagined having kids when I was little.
Kara had to put her medical ambitions on hold while she focused on providing her daughter with the care she needed. She stayed with her passion, though, finding a job at a doctor's office where she would be exposed to medical practice and make a decent paycheck. But when the doctor she was working for retired, she decided to go back to school.
It made me so nervous to think about not having a paycheck. My first and foremost priority was providing for her at that moment. Not, if I go to school for 4 years, I can provide this much better. It was always, you know, the here and now. And I think that's how a lot of people in poverty live. It's, you know, you worry about gas for that week. You worry about food for that week. You worry about how you're going to pay your rent for that month. You don't worry about, well, next year, what am I going to do? It's, you know, it's the here and now.
Right now, Josie and Caden are starting back to school, and Kara struggled to make sure they have all the supplies they need. The school they attend has a program to provide them with notebooks, pencils, whatever they need to get back to school. But the kids still need clothes.
My sister had given my daughter some new clothes that she had bought for herself that didn't fit. But I wasn't able to do that for her. And they both grow so fast. I mean, my daughter, she's almost as tall as me at 12, and she wears a women's 12 shoe. I can't keep her in shoes.
Josie and Caden know their mom struggles to keep the gas tank full, food in the fridge, and clothes on their backs. Kara wants them to know the reality of meeting their needs day to day.
But at the same time, I don't want to have to look at them and say, well, good luck. Go find something. I don't know what you're going to eat for supper tonight. You know, that's something that I worry about on my own. And I do what I have to behind the scenes and to make sure that they have food, or to make sure that I can borrow the money or sell something so they have money to go on their field trip.
Kara strives to keep the burden of poverty off her children, but all that stress builds, and it helps to have someone she can relate to. She enjoyed her work at the doctor's offices, surrounded by medical professionals, but she says they were vastly different from her. At college, Kara is able to connect with other people whose struggles are similar to her own. She can study with other parents while their children play together. Her social network has turned into her support network.
My friend Kelly, she's awesome. We've become like family. We help each other out. She was off work a while back. She was in the hospital a couple months ago, and she was in the situation I'm in now. And back then, you know, I went to the hospital. I took food to her house and we'd cook supper, or I'd give her $20 for gas and cigarettes, and she came by the other day. She got paid, and she walked in my door, threw a pack of cigarettes that had $10 in it at me, and she said, "Love you, bye, I'll see you later." And, you know, we don't even have to ask. We just help each other.
According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, about 28% of adults who live below the poverty line smoke. That's 11% higher than those who live at or above poverty level. Kara expected we may wonder why people who are barely scraping by spend money on something so frivolous like cigarettes that could cost them even more money and health problems down the line.
It's a stress reliever. I figured that would be one of the questions because they are expensive. I know that. I know they're expensive. I quit with both of my pregnancies. I don't smoke in my house around my kids. But when you have little to no income, you know, you don't get the advantage of taking a vacation to relieve stress. You get your small pleasures where you can. I know a lot of people don't understand that because they think, well, even if you spend $5 every 2 days, that's still a lot of money that you could be using toward your bills or this or that. But everybody wastes money in some way, whether it's a coffee at Starbucks or eating out for lunch with their friends. I know it's not healthy and I know I need to quit, but right now that's my sanity. That and good friends and caffeine is my sanity.
Kara luckily has yet to face any health problems related to cigarettes, but this last month she had surgery on her arm, which meant she couldn't work and didn't have a paycheck. Though her scholar housing and utilities are set at $61 a month based on her income, and she draws money from KTAP, she has had to rely on her support network.
The end of last month and this month so far has been very, very rough. My grandparents, God love them, I can call them and tell my grandmother I'll get a paycheck on the 30th. Is there any way you can let me borrow my car insurance money until then? And she'll move things around and put off her bills and do what she can to help me out. And there's been a lot of times, even when I was married, that we wouldn't have made it if it hadn't been for my grandmother.
Poverty is a situation people find themselves in, but some define it more as a mindset. Kara paused when we asked her if she ever considered herself actually in poverty. She began to answer, hesitating as she searched for the right words.
I've never really looked at it as being in poverty necessarily. I've always considered myself working class just because I've always worked. I mean, yeah, technically, I've been in poverty probably most of my life. Even when I had my good job, most of my money went to pay bills anyway, and there wasn't much to live off of after that. And so we had to budget and struggle and, you know, cut out things here and there.
Though Kara may not think of herself as poor, she is excited for the day she will start work as a nurse. She works hard to keep her little family content, and her kids are full of smiles and wisdom that they've picked up from her. They don't want for much more than stability, but Kara dreams of being able to afford a vacation for her children.
We lucked into a vacation last year. We'd never been on a vacation, and my friend moved to South Carolina to Charleston, and we drove down and helped her move, and we stayed for a week while we were down there, and it was wonderful. If that hadn't happened, I wouldn't have been able to afford to take them on a vacation. So I'd like to take them on maybe a Disney cruise. I think they'd like that.
Kara is on the verge of lifting her family out of a perpetual life on the line between poverty and stability, though there are things she would change if she could.
But everybody has those things, and every decision that you make, you know, leads to where you are, and I'm pretty content with where I'm at. I mean, if I had it to do over, I guess, like I said, I would have waited to have kids where I would have had gone to school and got my degree, gotten a job, gotten a house, gotten a car. But then I might be so happy with all that, I'd never have kids, and then I'd be missing out on this. And so who's to say I'd be happier like that?
As for Kara's possibilities getting out of poverty, they look pretty good. She can stay in her low-income scholar housing and work part-time at the college as long as she attends WKCTC, where she has 2 years to finish her RN degree. She hopes to specialize in surgical nursing. We spent the last hour peeking into the lives of three people in three different stages of a poverty cycle. As you've heard, there are so many variables that impact someone's financial situation, and there's no single solution to getting out. And despite the fact that some empirical research links money to happiness, it's admirable that Kara, Angie, and Joseph find ways to be happy and optimistic in situations where the data might not be as promising. Living on the Line is a WKMS News production produced by Whitney Jones, Allison Crawford, and me, Chad Lampe. Special thanks to Rob Canning for video production, the Purchase Area Development District's Marianne Medlock, Gwen Taylor at West Kentucky Community and Technical College, and Jennifer Bryson. We also thank MIT's Amy Glassmeyer, Ron Crouch, the State Demographer of Kentucky, and Murray State Professors David Eaton and Peggy Pittman-Monk for their assistance. I'm Chad Lampe. Thanks so much for listening.